Where do most people fail when buying commercial property? Hi, I'm Joe Krause. I'm the co-host of the Property Pals Australia podcast. And in this episode, Sam and I chat to Steve Polizzi, who is the founder of the buyer's agency firm Polizzi Property, where they've bought over 1,000 properties for clients. And he's also the author of the book Commercial Property Explained Simply. And in this podcast, Sam, Steve, and I touch on the top 5 risks that people need to comprehend when moving into buying commercial property investing. We also talk about why people without a general commercial property understanding can be far more at risk, can get caught out, and we also share how and where you can get some free education around commercial property investing. We also discuss how risky it is investing in commercial property without having a goal to work towards, with a strategy in place to execute towards that goal. We also discuss why focusing on mainly cash flow can be risky if you do not understand at what cost a high cash flow asset comes with. And lastly, we discuss how understanding lease agreements and market conditions is absolutely critical when assessing investing in a particular type of commercial property. Now, there's so much value in this podcast episode. There's links and resources in the show notes, so check those out. But now let's dive in. Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional. Steve, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for jumping on.
No worries. Thanks for having me on again, guys. Looking forward to this. And why aren't you wearing a white t-shirt, Jared?
Oh, I cooked it today, didn't I? I do have another one that I can go grab quickly.
But nah, that's fine. I'll let it slide this time, all right?
Take your shirt off, Jared, and just go no shirt.
So just before we hit the record buttons, Steve was telling us about his mates calling him the bear chest investor. So maybe I take a leaf out of your book. Bear chest investor today.
Yeah, that came from because when I'm on holidays, I don't live in clothes. I live in board shorts and no t-shirt. And I've had laser in the past, and my chest is very bare chest. And obviously, a Scott Pate barefoot investor, they've done a spin on that, and they call me the bare chested investor.
I love it. And that's what we're all about here. That's what Sam and I are about. Is like we are doing this for lifestyle, and we're helping people for lifestyle. Sam's going to be joining me in Bali pretty soon, about 2 months.
Yeah. Where's the invite?
Actually, jump on a plane as soon as you want. Just come over. You're welcome anytime.
Scotty and I are trying to organise a ski trip in Japan for early next year too, Steve.
So, let me post. I'm actually in Japan in 2 weeks' time. I've hired a camper van. I'm going to drive around for a couple of weeks.
Yes, yes.
Jared just got back from Japan.
About a week ago from Japan.
Yeah.
Anyway, lifestyle by design. But Steve, I don't care what you wear, mate. It's what's in between your ears that's the most valuable thing, not what you're wearing.
Got a bit of wax.
No, I doubt it. That's what we're tapping into today. So today we're going to talk about like key risks within commercial property. So Steve, what are like probably the 3 to 5 most common or biggest risks in commercial? And I know there's different asset classes, but maybe there's a few that relate to all the asset classes.
Yeah, I'll keep this general. So the first one is actually not understanding commercial generally. So like everything, because there are so many moving parts with like the tenant, the lease, the vacancies, the occupancies, foot traffic, road traffic, new developments and things like that. I've mentioned on previous podcasts, you can burn yourself a lot easier. So like that's probably the biggest one is lack of education and knowing the whole process. It's not like residential where you just do a couple checks like, oh, not in a flood zone, doesn't have termites. Yep, I'll be sweet here. This is a nice area long term. I'm going to be really fine. You have to have some level of education. And there's no excuse. We've got this podcast series. I've got my podcast series. There's a few books on the market. Like, get yourself generally educated. So at least you don't have to know it all. Like, that's the whole purpose of buyer's agents is you can use them. But at least an awareness, because no one cares about your wealth as much as you do. So at least no one's going to pull the wool over your eyes and buy you a dud property. You at least have a general kind of overview. So that's probably the first one, is lack of total understanding. You don't need the detailed one. We'll go that into that in another podcast, but total understanding. The next one is probably the risk of vacancy. So that's, and it's also one of the myths we mentioned previously as well. If you go buy a dud, the difference with residential is you just got to make up the difference in rent. With commercial, if you buy a high risk one and it sits there vacant for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, having $1 million or $2 million asset with no income is really going to financially sting you. Like that is the main concern. And we've spoken previously, Jared, about a lot of people fall into that trap. Sometimes with residential as well, they'll go by a really regional area because it's got a better, in quotation marks, cash flow. But then they miss out on the whole purpose, which is capital growth. Same thing sometimes happens for commercial. Like someone will go buy a property at, say, a 6.2% net yield on the far outskirts of a capital city where there's lots of greenfield, lots of supply, vacancy rates are really high, versus a bulletproof one at, say, 5.5%. where you're in the thick of it, next to the train stations, the ports, the airports, there's no more greenfield to be released. You're kind of locked in to kind of that scarcity factor. And for what? Like on $1 million property, the difference in 0.5% yield is $5,000 a year. So for me, risking $5,000 to try to like basically get a little bit more cash flow, but have a risk of like longer vacancies, lack of capital growth, lack of rental increases, your ROI risk is actually much more. So vacancy is the one I always focus on. If it's tenanted and the high yielding commercial at least pays for itself.
Sorry, Sam, just before you jump in, you're going to say something.
Come on, man. Give me the mic.
I just wanted to jump in and ask about, like, my association in my head. I have the higher the risk, typically, I mean, the higher the yield, typically, the higher the risk the asset is in terms of tenants. Is that a general good rule of thumb, or is it just like not good to think about that way?
Yes and no. So yes, when you get to the high end of the spectrum, like in this market, anything you buy above 7.5% net yield, there is a reason for that. Like you're either going quite regional in a high vacancy rate area, or the tenant's not strong and things like that. The no answer of it is it depends what you consider high risk. So like an example I use is let's say $1 million property. So say we want to buy $1 million warehouse. We can look in Sydney and we can go buy, let's say in the inner ring, so inner west, like an Alexandria or something like that. We can go buy a warehouse there at, say, a 4% net yield. And it's got tight vacancy rates, good tenancies, things like that. And it's going to be a little warehouse. It's going to be like 60 square meters max at that kind of price point. So is that more high risk than, say, buying in a different market like Brisbane, where we can get a 6% net yield, where the vacancy rates, instead of being like a week or two, might be a month? Because for me, like that difference in 2% is also a buffer, because we're literally getting a third more rent. We can have a third more vacancy and actually be in the same financial position. So it's kind of balancing that. So certain markets, it's the same argument for like residential. When someone goes, oh, what's lower risk, a $2 million house in Sydney or a 600K house in Brisbane or Perth? There's a pro and a con. You need to kind of assess why you're buying. Here's the secret. They all actually grow the same over the long term anyway. It's just out of different cycles if you buy the fundamentals correct. But the whole point of investing is obviously trying to, especially with commercial, get a cash flow return, but still get that capital growth so you win on both fronts.
It sounds like this is obviously my feedback from my path of work as well, is that people are so short-term focused, but they're investing for the long term. And it's because of that they're not, I guess, looking at that bigger picture. Is that obviously the same that you're seeing in commercial side of things as well?
Yeah, it's hard because the type of clients I attract obviously are gravitating towards my strategy. And like I see both ends of the spectrum. Like I get clients that are like, I want, must be 7% net yield, have value add. They're the kind of aggressive kind of ones. Then I get like the Sydney, Melbourne clients who actually just think they're like, oh, if I buy in Sydney or Melbourne at 4%, that's going to be really low risk because long term it's a stable performer. And it is in some regards. But like I said, what's like that one also has to grow more just to make up the yield difference. So it just depends what your strategy is. But exactly what you said, I always buy to about 10-year mindset. Like I try to predict 5 years for clients, because if I can get them capital growth in the next 5 years, then they do it all. But anyone talking, oh, this property is going to go off in the next 2 years, like the conversation I had yesterday, the Olympics just keeps popping up. People keep going, oh, the Olympics, it's going to perform really well. And I'm like, yeah, it's a great 20-year indicator. And they're like, no, like next couple of years, it'll boom. And I'm like, you might get a small spike from investor interest. But fundamentally, the infrastructure going in doesn't mean it grows now. Like, it's, they put the infrastructure in. The key with like Olympics is the infrastructure they put in gives it the ability to actually grow in 5 years' time, because they've got the train lines, the buses, the stadiums, the apartment blocks and things like that. That lets them come. And as someone who grew up during the 2000 Sydney Olympics, I can tell you after the Olympics, Sydney Olympic Park was ghost town for about 5 years. And now it's filled up. It's actually quite a nice area. There's cool restaurants and transport and things like that. But it's just a good indicator. And that's a macro driver. You're looking at, okay, what's this area going to do in 20 years' time? But if you're trying to plan for the next 5 years, you have to look at the numbers now.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. Like the with the different yields, would you say like Sydney markets and Melbourne, they're generally a tight of yields. Is that sort of like a leading indicator to see where, say, Brisbane could go? Do you look down that sort of that route?
Yes and no. In saying that, though, I'm still buying quite a lot in Sydney, for instance. Like I've purchased like, what, three or four in the last month in different areas, and they're still quite good yields. Like some of the areas have softened. Like we bought a couple on the northern beaches at 6% yield, and you're like, well, this is kind of brilliant we're getting there. It's the same argument as residential. No one actually knows. I look at like demand, basically, supply versus demand. If there's more people looking for that type of premise, that's either going to equate to rental growth or capital growth. And what's better, like the Northern Beaches ones where we're buying at a 0% vacancy rate versus an area with a few high percent yield with a 0.5% vacancy rate? Like which one's going to be the leading indicator? But that's why I generally try to buy stuff that's surrounded by residential property, so they're not releasing any more stock. And then looking at like population growth is a pretty good indicator for demand. Like if the population's set to double in the next 10 years, oh, sorry, it's like 30 to 40% increase, how are we going to have less demand for a warehouse or a medical center or a cafe? So it's just trying to match up that. But long term, if you keep those fundamentals, you'll keep the tenant, you'll keep the rental increases, you get the capital growth, it'll perform really well for you.
So coming back to risk, then would you say that very generally that for tenants, for, you know, you said tenant risk or loss of tenant, like vacancy rates and whatnot, the areas that have less of a population and more possible supply of product would be a riskier sort of place to invest than the opposite of that?
It's not so much the amount of population. I'd say it's population density is the kind of probably the correct term, because obviously like you can still buy a really low risk property in a regional area. Like Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast have some of the tightest vacancy rates in Australia for industrial property at the moment. Some beachfront areas or Blue Mountains in Sydney, like the main street there has really tight vacancy rates because there's only one main street. So even though it's kind of sprawled out, the population's still growing. It has that demand. So it just depends what and where you're buying. But I always just look at like, okay, who's actually going to be using these services? Why are they using it? Why is it actually going to grow long term? But go back to your thing is why is it low risk? That's where you assess. And like some buyer's agents go out and buy in like Mount Isa and Rockhampton and things like that, and they get like a 7% net yield, which is great while you've got the tenant. But if the vacancy rates there are 1 to 3 years, I don't care that I'm getting a 7% yield because that drops to zero. I would much rather a bulletproof 5 or 6% net yield that has rental increases, capital growth, lack of vacancy. Your ROI ends up being triple. So like, but again, on paper, theirs actually looks better than mine. They're like, well, why would I buy a 5% when I can get an extra 2% net yield? So it's just trying to match up. And none of them are actually wrong. It depends what you're actually buying for. Like that's probably the hardest one. And you can still buy low risk properties in high risk areas. So like getting a medical center in one of those high risk areas with a 10-year lease that's got a guarantor on it, cool, that can be low risk. We bought a shopping center in Townsville for a client where 2.4 mil, 12 different tenants. Cool. We're not doing that as a big capital growth play. We're doing that as a cash flow, low risk play. So you can still buy low risk in the regional markets, but going back to risk number one, it's understanding all those data that you need to know.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing that I like, do you have in your calculations, do you run cash buffers post-purchase just so people aren't like, some people come and they ask like, oh, I want to buy this property and I've got 100 grand. I want to use every single cent of it. And then for me, it's like, whoa, there's a risk in that even after purchase, you never know what might pop up. Like, do you have sort of like a rule of thumb around cash buffers post purchase?
Yes, but yes and no. So the cash buffers is basically dependent on what property you're buying. So like if I was buying a property that had 1 year left of the lease on it, we prepare for the vacancy. So when we do the vacancy study, if we're finding they're all getting filled at 1, 2, 3 months, I would probably say, look, at least have 6 months worth of interest repayments there so we can handle it. Okay. If it's got a 5 year lease and it's got a really good guarantor, so it's got like a good bond and a personal guarantee, that's lower risk because you're going to have 5 years of cash flow, hopefully where nothing can go wrong. Things can still go wrong, but like it's lower risk. And then over that 5 years, you can actually save a buffer. So if you are coming to me and you're like, look, I've only got 100 grand, I need to use all of it to get into the market, we'll try to assess that risk and kind of go from there. It's the same thing as residential, like how much buffer do you have? Probably a little bit for vacancy, probably more for maintenance. That's the one that kills it. Whereas something like a body corporate warehouse, if the admin and sinking fund has lots of money in it, cool, it's unlikely the special levy is going to pop up because they've got enough funds there. That one you kind of covered. There's no maintenance bills. So the only risk you actually have to take on is vacancy. And then if you're really worried, there are insurances. They cost a bit of a bomb, but you can get protection that way as well.
Yeah, that's good. That's what I love about commercial too over residential is, just your maintenance costs. You know, you can obviously put them to the tenant, right?
But a case by case. So 90% of the time, yes. Sometimes, no. So even if the lease says they cover 100% of the outgoings, say I buy a freestanding retail or industrial property and a new tenant moves in and 12 months later the roof collapses, even though that says they cover the maintenance, very unlikely they're going to put their hand up and be like, yep, Steve, don't worry, I've got this 50 grand bill. You just go relax in Bali. Like there's going to be a to and a fro there where so you still need some buffers. And that's part of the argument when I'm buying like a body corporate property, I actually don't mind them. Like, yes, you don't have as many value adds, but you've got a buffer. There's like 200, 300 grand in an admin sinking fund to protect you. So it's just that. But like I said, the value add you lose as well. Like I personally got a property in Ipswich in Brisbane that's freestanding with car spots. I can build up, I can renovate, I can like split tenancies. It's got me options there. But if you're just looking for a good base portfolio, like body corporate ones are actually really, really low risk.
Yeah. Like development risks, is that something that's sort of like a main, like overarching, or is that going further into your sort of more niche due diligence?
It's more niche if you're buying greenfield, so you're buying outskirts of a city or a regional town where it's high likelihood. If you're buying kind of in a ring, you can assess it pretty quickly. Go on Google Satellite, have a look at what's kind of going on. That'll tell you if there's any greenfield to do it. Then you obviously have to chat with the town planner, and then they'll tell you if there's any big developments kind of going on. But depends what you're buying. Like retail, I'd say is probably a bigger risk. If you're buying like a little suburban strip shop, like in a like just a general inner west area or whatever it may be of Sydney, that you probably want to make sure that they're not building like a Westfields or a Woolworths or something kind of around the corner that's going to take all your foot traffic away. But this is why like industrial is lower risk. Very hard for someone to go out and buy, I don't know, 50 houses to build a new industrial complex. But you're spot on, Sam. If you're buying on the outskirts, say you're buying, I'll keep you in Sydney because that's where I live, like out near Penrith, for instance, and there's lots of greenfields there. There's lots of newer estates coming there that you need to assess. There's a pro and a con of that as well. One of the pros of having newer estates is new properties actually sell for more. So all of a sudden, if you're buying a cheaper, like say warehouse, all of a sudden the comparables start going up and then they get a higher rent and it can actually pull you up with it as well. Assuming there's not an oversupply and it actually means your vacancy increases too much, but you can actually benefit. And that's also how an area grows. So I grew up in Sydney's West. It was farmland, like Kellyville and the Hills District didn't exist. Now it's a pristine spot. You go buy in Kellyville, Bella Vista, warehouses are $2, $3, $4 million for a stock standard warehouse. So you can long-term still do all right, but you need to mitigate the risk short-term.
This reminds me of something that I've heard. I don't know whether it's a complete myth in property investing, but buying the worst. The worst looking asset, I guess, in the best area that's going to get pulled up by, you know, other sort of properties that are on that street.
It is, but again, case by case. And this is a hard thing with commercial. I get sick of on phone calls and podcasts saying case by case because That works well, like in regards to comparable prices. But if let's just dramatize it. Let's say we've got an area where it's got all completely new warehouses and you all own one of them that's, I don't know, 50 years old. It seems good. You're like, oh, the comparable is going to be great. But similar to residential, you've still got an old warehouse that you're probably going to have to throw a few hundred grand into to uplift it or develop it, like knock it down and build again. So that's, you're sort of taking on another task in that regard. The other thing is depends on what you're buying. So a new industrial, it kind of gets different types of tenants. They normally have a bigger mix of, say, like office space. So it's kind of, they're more like the professional service type ones, like the engineering companies with a small product and things like that. If you're buying in like the outskirts of the city, they're more the, what I call like the dirty industrial, like the fabricators and the miners and the producers and things like that. So that one, they don't care when they're renting. They do not care what it looks like. It is all about floor space and getting the dollars right, like making sure they're not paying too much for it. So then this is why I hate these podcasts, because what you're buying and where you're buying is critical to how I answer the question, which is also why there's so many misconceptions and why we have to do 1,000 of these podcasts together just to scratch the surface.
Well, probably the best case is to book a call with you, mate, and have that strategy session to just get your own individual circumstances understood and then, you know, put that plan in place to make the right decision, really.
Yeah, and that comes back to what you said at the start of the podcast, Steve, is like one of the biggest risks is just not having a general knowledge of commercial. And, you know, I guess we just plug the book. We'll plug this podcast, plug your podcast.
Hopefully.
yeah, absolutely. And then plug the book. Guys, if you want Steve's book, he's giving it away for free. Just get the link in the show notes that we've got for you guys. So check that out and get your general understanding of commercial. So you kind of know, you know, a general understanding of like what you're going to be going for. Like that's another risk that you've mentioned before is people not knowing what they want, not having a bit of a strategy of like, what's the first property I should buy? What type of asset does it look like? What type of yield? What types of growth? Like, and then where do I go from there in 2, 5, 10 years time? Right.
Yeah.
For me personally, like I look, one of the biggest risks in investing is people wasting their time. Like all those things you just said, Jared, is so key. People are running through these things in their mind, and like the reality is they don't actually know. They need to start talking to those people that are doing it every day to help them fast track that whole process, because you can go get your borrowing capacity pretty easily, but then you're going to start running around going, oh, look at this office, I'll look at this retail, look at this industrial, and then you go down this rabbit hole, and it's just like you can shorten that time frame. And as Steve knows, the last 12 months and even the next 12 months is looking really good for capital growth. Like you're missing out on that opportunity cost of growth, which is huge.
You've literally just stolen my next point, when the next risk is actually like analysis paralysis. And people, like, you think it's hard with residential, it is 10 times harder with commercial, because you are not going to find a unicorn. You are not going to get the cheapest property in that area at the highest yield with the longest lease. You will sacrifice something, whether it be the yield, the lease length, the strength of the tenant, the age of the building, the proximity to the CBD. And then even once you find that deal that you're happy with, due diligence, which we'll go over in the next episode, will actually uncover red flags. You'll find something, like the lease isn't registered, the mezzanine's not approved. Like it's, I actually get more scared when I find a perfect property, because I'm like, I'm missing something here. How did I get this at this price? And I actually start second guessing myself. So I'm the opposite. Most people get the other way around. I get scared when I find a perfect property because I feel like I've missed something.
Yeah, absolutely. I do that with investors when we're buying business. I'm like, damn, this is really good. Like what's going on here?
What are they lying about?
yeah. There's something swept under the rug and it's, you know, it's very well hidden.
One of the things I actually like, assuming it's not a leaseback commercial, is because you get to talk to the tenant, they are brutally honest with you. They will tell you, because there's no incentive for them for sugarcoating the property. They actually want to tell you everything is wrong with it so you can fix it. They'll always cry poor as well. They'll be like, oh, I'm paying too much rent. I heard this guy's paying this, blah, 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 which is also good as well. But they're kind of like a little insurance policy. They tell you like, oh, I've been here for 5 years. This like unit, say, had a leaky roof. The body corporate's really slow. And that's part of our questions as well. We actually go through all the negatives of the property.
That's a good point on the leasebacks. So how often do you buy leasebacks, and Are they more susceptible to, I mean, deception in a way?
Generally, yes. So, like, on average, there's a reason why they're doing a lease back. I can't give you a percentage, but sometimes they're legit. So, like, sometimes there's a genuine thing for it. Like, they're trying to expand the business and they want to get it because businesses aren't property owners. Like, sometimes when you're starting a business, you might buy a warehouse and go, oh, this is great, I'll with it. But then if the business does really, really well, their funds are actually better deployed into growing the business and doubling the revenue. So actually offloading it and leasing the premises back actually makes sense. What normally happens, you can normally tell pretty quickly, is they'll put themselves on a long lease and a high rental rate. So it makes the property look really, really, really attractive so they can get a good price. But that's part of knowing what you're doing and actually looking at the actual, basically make your offer based on the fair market rate, not what they're paying, and go from there. But yeah, there is a bit more risk with it, but also some genuine ones. The other one that kind of comes up occasionally is actually rental guarantees. So when they're selling the property, they might not have a tenant and they actually offer the selling of the property with like a 12 or 24 month rental guarantee, which generally just means they're going to pay you the fair market rent or whatever rent you agree on for that period while you find another tenant. As soon as you get another tenant, then that stops and moves on. There's a couple legitimate reasons why they do that. The illegitimate one is obviously trying to get a good price out of it because they're like, oh, look, we're guaranteeing you rent. Same as you see in residential where they're like, rental guarantee, it's a great spot. We'll guarantee $450 a week rent for 2 years. If it's a hotspot area, why do they have to guarantee it? Like, you should be able to get it in a week or two. But the main reason they do that is because they actually get to look at selling it to two different people. They can sell it to investors because part of getting your investment loan is you need to show the income. It's not like Resi where you get a rental appraisal and that's all you need. So you need an actual lease to be able to get finance. So they can sell it to an investor. The other one is because they don't have a tenant, they can actually sell it to an owner-occupier. So they actually just get to advertise to a much wider net of people, which in their turn is going to obviously get them the best price. So that's sometimes a smart way to do it. It's good for me because I understand how to analyze it. But like you mentioned, we're talking risk. For a first-time investor, you are going to literally poop your pants if you start trying to assess, oh, what's this rental guarantee about? And you're going to just disregard that property. But I always tell people as well, you shouldn't be that focused on what the lease has now. Like if you're buying an industrial property and it's got 12 months left on the lease, I treat that exactly the same as having 3-year lease. And people are like, oh no, but I want the 3-year lease. And I'm like, what difference does it make if it goes vacant in 12 months time or 36 months time? Like you've still got a vacant property. You are going to lose your tenant at some point, whether it be 2 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. So how's it going to stack up then? So like that's what I mentioned before about that 10-year kind of mindset. I don't want to sound flippant, but unless it's a blue chip tenant, I don't really care about the lease. It's all about the quality of the property, where it is. The lease is just there so I can get finance. And then obviously it's nice if you get a 5-year lease, you don't have to worry about it. But like I said, if it goes vacant in 5 years' time or 12 months' time, it's the same net result anyway. Part of the DD process is you call the tenant and if they're like, oh yeah, we're going to stay on for the next 5 years after this 12 months, cool. I've guaranteed 6 years lease now.
Yeah, that's a really good question I want to ask around like getting finance and the lease. So just for people listening, Steve and I are going to talk about this probably in another pod, probably on mine, one version, and then on yours, Steve, one version as well.
Yeah.
I'm looking at property with you guys at the moment and there's a deal where the lease is going to end and then we're obviously going to secure a better lease, but I need the lease for financing, obviously. So what happens? Like, do we need to have the lease put in? You need to have the lease confirmed and put in place before you go for it, before you, you know,
get. Yeah. This is the hard one. It depends, Jared, on like what lender we're going to. Sometimes some lenders will accept an actual letter of intent. So the tenant basically sign a letter. Other ones, we actually have to wait for it. But normally what happens is once you're under contract and you're subject to finance and due diligence, stuff happens because the owner actually has to do things because he wants to sell. So if you like satisfy DD and like you say finance, all we need for finance is the new lease signed, then it kind of happens within a couple of weeks. There's always delays. And again, it's one of the pain in the bum things with commercial. It might blow out for 5, 6, 7 weeks. But yeah, you need generally the lease. Sometimes you don't know. Like I got clients where they've got serviceability. They don't need the lease. The rent doesn't actually matter. They can still get the finance for it. And then other ones where, especially lease stock, you need a long lease. Like they're giving you a loan based on that lease. So then it depends whether you're going full dock, if serviceability is an issue. If serviceability, like say the halfway point, like you've got enough servicing even with a lower rent, you might still get the loan done. But if it's lease dock, there's the stuff I need to hit. I need to hit certain yields, certain length leases, and they're a bit harder because the lease is the whole pivotal point on it.
Sounds like it's a case-by-case scenario there, Steve.
There we go. You're learning. Yeah, we're podcasting. We're finally learning.
talking about learning, we'll wrap it up and we'll come back to you guys with another pod from Steve. But check out the link in the show notes to Steve's book. It's awesome. Sam and I both read it. We recommend you reading it. It's free. So,
well, it's $40, mate. It's not free, but if you use Property Pals as a code, then yeah, it's free.
Correct.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Then you just remove that risk of not having the general knowledge about commercial. It goes through, like, you know, expenditures, costs, risks, so many things. So thanks so much for coming on again, Steve, and looking forward to chatting again soon.
Awesome, boys. See you in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Take that shirt off, mate.
Yeah, change changing shirt. Get back to the bare-chested investor.
I'll go white this time.
See you, lads.